Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi, introducing you to new non-fiction books full of original, memorable insights. Omi, from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode,
I'm Dave Evans, co-author of Designing Your Work Life, and this is my Omi for Bookomi.
We're meeting the man who left a successful career in Silicon Valley at places like Apple and Electronic Arts to help us all design a better life.
It just means taking that design step of mindfulness of process, collaboration, and empathy, and understanding what's going on. Reality is the only place things happen. Just get better at reality.
Dave Evans is the co-founder of the Stanford Life Design Lab. Along with his co-author, Bill Burnett, he's written a follow-up to the massive 2017 hit Designing Your Life by adding one word to the original title. Designing Your Work Life reframes the meaning and the purpose we see in our day jobs to build a way forward in your current job or past as new. Dave, welcome to Bookomi.
Richard, thanks so much.
The working landscape, I don't know how you can keep up with it, really. It's changed so much in the last 6 months. Working life will never be the same again, will it? Or will it? Will we return to normal ways of working?
Well, the honest answer is we absolutely have no idea. But I think the smart money is on things will not be the same. We are not going back to the old place. We are going to a new place that we've not yet seen.
And do you think it'll be for the better or the worse? Do you think we've learned things about ourselves? And do you think we appreciate work more because we miss other people?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, in New York City, you know, having lived in both in New York City and in London, you know, those are both huge financial centers, large corporations. What's going on in New York, and I believe it's going on in London as well, is that some big corporations are realizing, gosh, how could we possibly run this company without everybody in the building? Oh, surprisingly well, maybe we don't need to spend that much money on real estate. Commercial real estate is going to go through a massive upheaval. That's only one example. And is that for the worse or the better? Well, if you're the commercial real estate agent that had that account, you know, you're maybe not so thrilled. If you're the organization that's realizing suddenly we really can become more global more easily, we can find a way to lean into this. Not only is the smart forecast on things will be different, but I think the smart leaders will be able to find ways to respond to those changes so that in retrospect, they'll say it was for the better. Some people who will get stuck will say, oh, no, it was all for the worse. It frankly depends on your response. The change is just a change. The change has no attitude about you. Whether it's a good change or a bad change is up to you.
That's interesting. And it's a very stoic point of view and pragmatic. So let's talk about the book. That's a good way into the book. You set the reader up with a series of problems and situations that need unpacking and reframing, like being unhappy at work, wanting more money, recognition, social status, all of which can be seen through a new lens if we see life as a process rather than an outcome. How did you personally reach this insight?
Well, first of all, this is our follow-on book, right? This is the sequel, as you artfully said in the introduction. We just tacked one more word into the title, Designing Your Work Life. Where'd that come from? Where that came from was the now pushing 600,000 people who've been reading our book and, you know, 60-odd thousand people on our electronic community. And then our publisher came to us and said, gosh, we think this is it's not a book, it's a movement, Dave and Bill, you know, which was a little much, but nonetheless, and we got to keep this thing going. So we had conversations. And clearly the number one thing on people's minds is we were out there, you know, in the world, back when you could go in person and meet people face-to-face, which we did to the tune of many tens of thousands of times with individual conversations and large group meetings, video events, and then feedback to us and to the publisher. Work was what people had on their minds. It's really struggling. Can I make it a little bit better at work? Where we spend the large majority of our physical time, the largest single expression of human energy on the planet, always has been, probably always will be, with or without Zoom. It's still the place we go. And so the idea of applying these principles of design thinking, because of course we're continually designing our work. And in fact, that idea alone is the first thing to get unstuck from. Like, I really need to wait for my boss. I really need a new job. I need to work for a new company. In order for it to be any better. Because, of course, I'm just stuck with the thing that they gave me, aren't I? And the answer is no, you're not.
Well, there's a pragmatism running through the book, which is really refreshing. You don't pretend that life or work can be perfect or that moonshots are the only shots worth taking. In fact, you encourage the reader to set the bar low sometimes just to get started. And I was looking up your videos on YouTube, and right after yours, one popped up promoting a course to get the millionaire mindset, $10,000 a week just by clicking the link and taking action. How do you feel about such promises to people, especially people who might be unhappy or vulnerable?
We find those kinds of offers somewhere between, you know, fatuous and enraging, frankly. You know, design thinking, the term design thinking is the modern moniker for the technical term human-centered design, which was, you know, begun to be developed at Stanford back in the 60s. You know, Bill Burnett is the fourth guy to hold the title of the director of the design program at Stanford. You know, he was put there by David Kelly, who is still there, the founder of IDEO, who stands on the shoulders of Bob McKim, who stands on the shoulders of Jim Arnold. It goes way back. And it's all about making things that people can really use for human beings, and doing it in a way, in a process that's human itself. The human part of human-centered design is both human designing of products and processes that humans can really use. In this case, designing for ourselves. And so it's all a fundamentally, you know, anthropologically centered approach to, let's do this as humanly as we can. That's the only thing that's really going to work. It's only the only kind thing, but it is, as you said, the only practical thing. So we think a lot of what's out there that's so inspirational. There's so many, you know, Marvel comic movies out nowadays. A popular, you know, cute question is, hey, Richard, what's your superpower? What's your superpower?
You asking me?
And I kind of love getting that question, because when I get it, I say, oh, I don't have one. I'm not superhuman. I'm just human. And superhuman is just a snazzy way of saying inhuman. And so if I want to inspire people to be their superhuman self, what am I doing? I'm just getting you all emotional about something that's inhumanly undoable. So I can get you all cranked up. You can be your amazing, you can be your gold medal self all the time, Richard. Come on, you can do it. That sounds wonderful, but it's just patently untrue. I'm actually morally incensed by some of that stuff, to be honest with you. We really believe it is unkind to give anybody something that they can't actually do. And doability is the number one thing we hear back. Hey, you know, I think I could actually do this. It's why we made a whole section of the book, as you pointed out, the set the bar low and clear it method. We formally, between book one and two, we formally named this response and said, no, we have a policy. We are in favor of setting the bar low. We are not setting the bar high. Now set the bar low and repeat. You know, that's how real change actually occurs. That's what the science actually says.
Well, it's and that is very refreshing, and it really caught my eye and caught my mind as well. And the human aspect of what you talk about is, yeah, it's palpable as you're reading the book. And also the attitude to other people, or how we are part of a network of other people, whether we work by ourselves or in groups. And hell and heaven is other people in a way. There's a great section in the book on dealing with someone that you might perceive as being a jerk. If we imagine if someone is getting in the way of our designed working life by their behavior, how should we reframe that problem?
You know, the other day, somebody asked me, what's the best piece of advice you ever got? And I hate superlatives. You know, what was your worst possible day? What was your best possible thing? What's your best attribute? I mean, I hate singular answers. But in trying to generate an answer to that question, I said, well, you know, a long, long time ago, a former lawyer who had become the general manager of a large division of a big corporation that I was working in said, now, you know, Dave, don't forget, everybody's coming from somewhere. I said, Jack, what are you talking about? And he said, well, everybody's coming from somewhere, Dave. They've got a point of view. I go, I know, that's obvious, Jack. Why is this interesting? He says, what I'm telling you, Dave, is, believe it or not, 95% of the time, 95% of the people are trying to help. That thing they're doing that's making you crazy, it makes sense to them. They're coming from somewhere, and they actually think where they're coming from is helpful. So before you jump in and go nuts, you might want to figure out what's on their mind. And even if you're going to try to change them or invite them to change themselves, understanding where they're coming from is going to give you some leverage. Just remember, everybody's coming from somewhere. So when you run into somebody who's doing something that's either bothering you or confusing you, and you're tempted to say, what a jerk. Or as I was presenting this to one company one time, a guy stood up and said, no, no, no. In our company, it's what a stupid jerk. And it happens all the time. And, you know, so the person who's stupid or a jerk, once you go down the pathway of deciding that somebody is stupid or a jerk, and you're wrong, they're just misled, or they're uninformed, or maybe they're doing it differently than you had, or their style's a little clunky, but nonetheless, they had something in mind. Backing off of that is almost impossible. Reversing out of overreacting to the stupid jerk is incredibly difficult. But the key thing to remember is, okay, let's assume for the moment, I'm going to assign preemptively, noble intention and some degree of thoughtfulness to this ridiculous behavior. I'm going to go ask a different question, you know, which is, oh, what's going on? What's actually going on? How's this working for you? And it's not that hard to find out, as it turns out. And once you do, it may indeed be the wrong thing, but now you go, oh, now I get it. So you literally have to give the benefit of the doubt. The old phrase, the cliche, give the benefit of the doubt. If you take that literally and think of I doubt your intention. You know, I'm not sure you're doing the right thing here, Richard. What am I going to do with that doubt? I'm going to put it in a box. I'm going to wrap it up, put a bow on it, and set it aside. And I'm going to allow you to enjoy the benefit of me giving to you, giving away my doubt and presupposing you're really doing the right thing, at least in your mind. For a moment, this is a way to be empathetic with your nobler than it looks to me like you are right now self. And in so doing, you know, if you raise somebody else's bar, they might step up to it. You know, expect little of people and they'll seldom disappoint you. Now, this is not magic. This isn't how to suddenly give somebody a new personality. And often enough, you'll go, oh, and now I know you are, in fact, a jerk, or you're unbelievably uninformed. You may not be stupid. Your IQ is fine, but boy, do you not know what's really going on. And then I can act accordingly. I can jump to reacting negatively very quickly. It takes 2-3 seconds. To respond empathetically and thoughtfully, to really understand, it just means taking that design step of mindfulness of process, collaboration, and empathy, and understanding what's going on. Reality is the only place things happen. Just get better at reality.
And it's that the proximity between your expectations and reality, which is where happiness lies, isn't it? The closer those two things are to each other, then the happier you are, I suppose. So if you expect someone to be perfect and they're not, you're going to be unhappy. If you expect your life to be perfect and it's not, you're going to be unhappy. It's that balance I see that you're measuring all the way through in the book. But there's a moral compass as well to what you're saying. And correct me if I'm wrong, I sense this and a philosophical point being made throughout the book that's kind of to thine own self be true. If we need praise, like we might have got from a lovely third grade teacher, as you describe, we should maybe accept that and seek it out in people. Or should we just grow up and accept that not everyone in the world is as bothered about my feelings as I am?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're referring to, there's an example in the book where somebody, what they're unhappy about at work is they never get any positive feedback. And what do I do about that? You know, what one response is, well, grow up. You know, you look at your paycheck, that's the feedback you get. You know, the rest is just do your job. Shut up and sit down. That's one response. The other is, wait a minute, you know, we're human beings here, and human beings run on relationship and feedback, and feedback is part of the program. I need to find a way to get myself some feedback. This is a good example of, you know, even morally, what do I deserve? And we try to avoid getting too morally animated too often, or at least more often than we need to be, because it just adds all kinds of emotions that aren't free. But at least start practically, get the objective work done first. So what is exactly going on? Let's say in this particular case, I've now come to the conclusion, you know, that my boss does not provide personal feedback, full stop. You know, he gives assignments, he says you're right or you're wrong, but you know, either praise or constructive criticism, I mean, all that qualitative stuff that I might thrive on, just not gonna happen. So then I take a look objectively at what my options really are. You know, and if I decide I do want feedback, am I going to get it from him? You know, in this conversation, let's say it turns out, well, gosh, you know, I mean, clearly, you know, and one thing you do when you do lots of interviews like Bill and I do is you very quickly identify who are the prepared interviewers and who are the unprepared interviewers. And Richard, I'm happy to announce you are clearly a very well prepared interviewer. Thank but let's you. Say it turns out you don't give any feedback. You just give questions. You know, if I want feedback, I can establish a relationship with Rachel. You know, our engineer that, you know, is offline here. So I've got to just play the game smart. So the whole thing we're trying to do is give people tools that will work in reality. Acceptance, step zero of the design process, is crucial to everything. You can't solve a problem you're not willing to have. Most people's problem isn't their problem. It's their problem with their problem. The problem isn't my boss doesn't give feedback. The problem is I really hate that. I'm really mad that the general manager, the executive director, put in place this manager that doesn't give feedback. I'm really mad about that whole thing. Well, great. Good luck with it.
And do you think that's a generational thing? Because we've been through different cycles of boom and bust where jobs have been aplenty. We're running into a wall of unemployment at the moment. Do you think people appreciate employment in times of need more and therefore have different expectations and different views of how they should fit into working life and what it should give them?
You know, I really do believe that the definition of healthy work has not changed in a long time. I think what people are looking for in the collaborative human experience of participating in the human adventure that we call work, you know, we're all out there, whether it's the for-profit world or the nonprofit world or the government world or the military world or the education world, you know, we're on the playing field of the human adventure of civilization. People want to play, want to participate, they want to self-support. And what the people are looking for has been pretty consistent for a long time. Now, in different generational moments, in different economic epochs, some things go well, some things go poorly. And that particular profile of what's going well, what's going poorly, where are the big changes occurring in the system? Those deeply affect people often at a generational level. You know, if you lived through the Great Depression in the late 20s and the early 30s, if you lived through the Spanish flu right after World War I, if you lived through the first dot-com bubble burst, et cetera, et cetera. And then the generations entering the workforce in their 20s and early 30s during those incredibly important periods of time often form points of view that are deeply informed by those unique experiences. So right now, you know, we're spending a lot of time talking to people about work in the era of the COVID pandemic. We actually have a little video series on YouTube called Designing Your COVID Life. I think we've got 6 videos up. And so people who are starting their careers, that's a very formative time. And so the social aspect, the interactive aspect, how we collaborate in the workplace is going to be a huge part of the point of view of workers who are just starting their careers right now. So I think timing matters. I don't think humans care, want more social reinforcement now than they used to. They need it more. I think we are being shown things we took for granted. I hope that will make people more appreciative of one another.
Well, I suppose people are more concerned at the moment maybe with keeping rather than leaving their job. But I really liked your chapter on quitting, or generative leaving, as you put it. How do we leave well without burning bridges?
Yeah, you know, it's we've got a chapter on don't resign, redesign. So how can you get a new job in place, and one on quitting well? Because at some point you're going to quit. I mean, for COVID notwithstanding, you know, modern workers, those people who are listening to me, you know, in their 30s, are probably going to live to a healthy 100. They're going to work for 75 years. They're going to have probably 20 jobs and probably anywhere from 2 to 4 careers. I'm on my 6th career. I'm 67. So holy cow, you're going to change jobs, which means you're going to quit. Quitting is in your future. And for some people, by the way, I would even say termination. Let's say you're involuntarily terminated. You're downsized. You know, my wife and I have 5 adult children, 4 are married, we have 8.6 grandchildren, the 9th one's due in October, you know, and I've got some children and children-in-law who are working in, you know, like Netflix, which is working their tails off, and some working in the hotel industry who are laid off. So depending where you are in this thing, you know, work is coming and going. And even if you're laid off, how do you leave? Somebody else decides you're about to quit. These principles still apply, frankly. And so quitting well boils down to realizing it's simply a part of the process. You know, my life of work will involve transition. I absolutely want it to include some new things, which means it's going to have had some old things, and old things come to an end. Quitting is just the thing we called ending. And what you want to do is recognize that if it's all part of one fabric, and you want your reputation to matter to people when you're gone, you want the work you did to sustain and be of some value in your absence, then what you want to do is you want to quit well and with care, what we call quitting generative. Don't make quitting, I mean, there's always things you're glad to get rid of. So focus on what went well, not what went poorly. And as you go out the door, you know, take a couple of steps that will allow you to be well-remembered, well-referred and referenced, and frankly, leave you feeling better about the work as well. That catapults you positively into your next role rather than, you know, runs you out the door with a trail of smoke and flame behind the car.
And what about people who want to use this seismic shift in working life as an opportunity to be their own boss? How do they design their way into a future of self-employment?
Yeah, welcome to the gig economy. It's been around for a long time. It is on the way to exploding before the pandemic, and now it is massively. So many people are saying, gosh, you know, I could probably pull this off now. And some people are being invited to do that whether they want to or not. Absolutely, we got a whole chapter in the book on how to be your own boss, how to go from being an employee to being a contractor. And the way you do that is for most people, the natural thing is rather than, you know, I was a field salesperson and now I'm going to go into becoming, you know, a rent a tax preparing accountant. Now, that's probably not the change you're going to make. You're probably going to take the kind of thing you did before and you're going to keep doing it. So if you're in sales, you're going to become an independent distributor. You know, if you are in marketing, you're going to become a strategy consultant. And so what that means is you need to start prototyping. You go back to the set the bar low and clear it method. And if at all possible, by the way, you have absolutely begin doing this before you leave your employment. The stats are very clear when you're going from having a job to getting another job, getting another employment job. You know, you're 68% more likely to be employed if you're still employed, because it's impossible for the mind to not answer the question, gosh, all those other people who aren't hiring you right now, if you're standing there unemployed, what do they know that I don't? You know, that question has to be answered, you know, which is why, by the way, if due to COVID or other economic macro behaviors, you're unemployed for benign reasons, that question is not a big issue. No one's going to blame you for the fact that there's a global pandemic. But that being said, you start foraying into ways that people use the kind of work you're doing. And even if the early work you're doing is free, you know, you just, what you need is some projects where you help some people out. You worked on some things. You could put your, you know, someone can, you know, call back Richard or Rachel and say, hey, I understand, you know, you worked with Dave one time. You know, how is that? So what you want to do is start having these conversations, and it starts with conversation. The first thing you're doing is not selling your services. The first thing you're doing is having probably a couple of dozen, what we call life design prototype conversations. To explore what it's like, and particularly how is it that people who do these things as contractors and send invoices different than people who do it on the payroll and get a paycheck. You know, the 10-word version of our simple process for this developmental approach, which is true both for finding a new job and starting a gig, would be get curious, talk to people, try stuff, then tell your story. So 4 sentences, 10 words, get curious, talk to people, try stuff, tell your story. And where people get in trouble shifting into a gig economy kind of work is they try to jump to tell the story, which is pitching their services too soon. They haven't gotten curious. They haven't talked to enough people and they haven't tried enough things. So that by the time you're telling your story, which is now actually advocating for your work, you've got something interesting to say.
Well, there's so much wisdom and experience distilled into the book, Dave. You've certainly helped me, I think, redesign my work life. The book is excellent. Thanks for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
Been great to be here. Thanks so much.
Dave's book, Designing Your Work Life, How to Thrive and Change and Find Happiness at Work, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction before anyone else, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bookomi.com. Meanwhile, if you've enjoyed this Bookomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe, and remember, you only get one work life, so live it well. Bye for now.